Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
All right, Alan Zweibel started his comedy career selling jokes for $7 a piece to the last of the Borscht Belt stand-ups. Then one night, despite bombing on stage, he caught the attention of Lorne Michaels and became one of the first writers on Saturday Night Live, where he penned classic material for Gilda Radner, John Belushi, and all the original Not Ready for Primetime players. From SNL, he went on to have his hand in a series of landmark shows, from its Gary Shandling show to Curb Your Enthusiasm. And throughout the pages of his new book, Laugh Lines, Alan weaves together his own stories and interviews with his friends and contemporaries. The book also features a foreword by his friend of 45 years, Billy Crystal, with whom he co-wrote and co-produced the upcoming film Here Today. He's an Emmy, Tony, and Thurber Prize award-winning writer, and to share this journey, Alan Zweibel joins us tonight. Alan, how are you?
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm great.
Absolutely fantastic. You started, first of all, on Saturday Night Live 45 years ago. It truly does not feel that that first episode was that long ago.
Well, you know, here's something even weirder. Next Wednesday, I'm going to be 70. Now, how the hell did that happen?
When the hell did that happen?
We started SNL, I was 25, and now I'm 70. What's that?
What is that? And you think about this, man. Belushi, Chase, Aykroyd, Curtin, Newman, Morris, Murray, and of course, Gilda Radner. That's when I first read one of your books. It was like 25 years ago on your friendship with Gilda.
Yeah, it was called Bunny Bunny, Gilda Radner, A Sort of Love Story. And I wrote that book because, well, my wife encouraged me to write something about Gilda after she passed. She said, look, your best friend died. You haven't cried yet. And, so I reconstructed my relationship with Gilda. And it came out to be this book called Bunny Bunny, which was then a play.
Right.
And now there are some people who want me to rewrite it and bring it to Broadway. So God knows.
I like that. George Carlin, who was the first guest host ever on SNL, was part of your inspiration to kind of get into all this?
Well, he was very much so, because what George Carlin was to all of us was somebody who spoke our language. You know, when I wrote for those stand-up comedians in the Catskills, I was 21 and 22. They were 45 and 50. It was like writing for my parents' friends, you know?
Right.
And you know, Watergate had just happened, and Nixon resigned, and it was Vietnam, and we were the sons and daughters of those Catskill guys, and we had our own point of view. And George Carlin, if not the first, was one of the first who started talking about those things. And, you know, he was part of a comedy team with Jack Burns.
They wore
tuxedos. So they were essentially Catskill comic. They were an act. A Catskill comic kind of act. And in a strange way, unbeknownst to me, I followed a similar sort of direction. I got tired of writing for those guys, and I wanted to have a place where I can talk about what was going on in our lives.
And I noted you were writing jokes for $7 a piece and mailing them to The Tonight Show, The Dick Cavett Show. And you note that your efforts were rewarded with 3-inch stack form rejection letters, not to mention from Mad Magazine, National Lampoon. But even though they were rejection letters, at that time in your life, you were looking for some feedback. You wanted to know that you were heading in the right direction.
When I was in college, I went to the University of Buffalo, and Dick Cavett had a show, and Johnny Carson had the Tonight Show. And what I would do is I would write jokes, and I would mail them into New York City on Monday. And like by Thursday, I watched their shows, and I wouldn't say that they took the jokes, because that's not the case at all, but I found that my jokes were close enough, okay, to what the professional writers were writing, and I found that encouraging.
And that was something, again, as a young kid, I mean, you know, being rejected in such a way on something that you want to do in your life has got to be, to some people, that would be pretty tough. And some people might walk away from that. But I mean, you really looked at it as inspiration. You were just going to keep trying until you found that right path.
Yes, I did. You know, there was something really snotty about
it. I like it. It's aggressive. It's good.
There was a degree of moxie that I had. Well, wait a second. I think this is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, let me find somebody who does, you know. And, you know, in everybody's career, no matter, whether you're selling jokes to comics in the Catskills or writing movies or plays, all of those things which I do now, I come to expect that people are going to like what you did, or some people won't. Hopefully more people do like what you did.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
you were starting to hang out at the Improv. So after all this, you know, Catch a Rising Star, you made some lifelong friends in this, you know, name-dropping Larry David, Richard Lewis. So you were in good company on this journey.
Well, yes. What happened was I took the jokes those old guys wouldn't buy from me, and I found these two clubs in the city. And, that you know, these clubs were now the breeding ground. That's right. Where my buddy Larry David was starting, and David Brenner was there, and Lily Tomlin and Richard Pryor and Bette Midler. And I'm going, okay, this is closer to my age. It's closer to my sensibility. And the first week that I started hanging out at the clubs, I met a guy named Billy Crystal, and who lived four towns over from my parents. I would move back in with my parents after college, and he was married and had a child. And he used to pick me up every night in his little blue Volkswagen. We would drive into the city, tell our jokes, and on the way back, listen to the cassettes and critique each other about, you know, oh, maybe if you said it this way, oh, that new line does work, it doesn't work. And here we are 45 years later. We just did, like you said in the intro, we just completed a movie that we co-wrote, Billy directed, and he stars with Tiffany Haddish, called Here Today. And, you know, and also in there also about 20-ish years ago now, we went to Broadway and won a Tony for a one-man show that I collaborated with Billy on called 700 Sundays.
Right.
So aside from being Uncle Billy to my kids, this is, I made a lifelong friend there.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. And speaking of other friends, you know, you were with your pal Richard Lewis when you found out you got SNL. And that must have been a big wow, because, you know, it was, Saturday Night was just a title. Nobody knew what that was. No one knew what it meant.
Oh, David, let me tell you something, okay? As luck would have it, all right, the same week, literally, the same week that Lorne Michaels, we got the phone call. Yes, I was at Richard Lewis's house. We were working on a spec script for Robert Klein, all right? And Richard had a house. He was living behind somebody's house. They converted the garage, okay?
Gotcha.
And that was his house, but he had a phone. He had a bathroom. Those are things I didn't have, okay? And the phone and the call came that I got a job on this new show called Saturday Night Live. As fate would have it, literally that same week, I got another call saying that I got a job. I was offered a job writing the questions and bluff answers for Paul Lynde in the Hollywood Square. Okay?
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah.
Now, in 2020, it sounds like an absurdity. Well, what's the problem? You know, where's the dilemma? But back then, you know, Hollywood Squares
was big.
Prime time. It was going into its ninth season.
Absolutely.
It was the West Coast where the whole industry was. It had all of these stars in, you know, in the boxes there, all with Las Vegas acts, all with their variety shows. And they go, oh, what, this is an entree into the business. Where is this Saturday Night Live thing, 11:30 to 1 on Saturday night? Who watches TV then? You know, John Belushi, who's that? You know,
right.
And I debated it for about, always second.
Right. Yeah.
And I think I made the right choice.
Absolutely. I remember, I mean, first of all, you know, I was born in 67. So me staying up late and watching those first couple seasons was taboo. I'd like have to sneak around and watch that show. And it was just done so well. And I actually remember you being on stage as well. I know you're writing, but I saw you in a lot of those skits.
Oh, yeah. Whenever they needed a big Jewish person to look stoned, dead, you know, or have a prefrontal lobotomy, there was a sketch, commercial parody that Al Franken and his partner Tom Davis wrote for a beer called Spud Beer.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted me to play the patient who had just had electroshock therapy. All right. Because the tagline for Spud Beer is for people who don't know the difference.
Okay? That's awesome.
And we went to an infirmary a little north of New York City at a college, and they put me in a hospital gown, and they led me in from the outside into this room and put me in the hospital bed. All right. And this was what it was. This was the first thing I think they shot for the show ever. And the director, Dave Wilson, kept on saying, cut, Alan, let's do it again. Let's do it again. We did it five or six times. And then he takes me aside. He says, listen, don't act the part. This is of somebody who just had electric shock therapy. Don't act that way. Just be yourself. Look the way you do. Walk the way you do.
I'm thinking
to myself, oh, what kind of show is this going to be? So the next take, I just went through it the way I go through every day of my life. And they got perfect. Let's go to lunch.
but you became a little nervous doing these things, and I know you wrote in the book that, you know, Gilda would help try to keep you centered in being in a scene with maybe a little vodka.
A little bit of vodka, and I go there, but still, you know, when the camera was on me, well, let's put it this way. There was a scene we did. I can't remember what show it was, but I remember seeing it in a rerun. I was playing a corpse. I was in a casket. All I had to do was lie there, okay? And if you look closely, my hands are shaking.
I was nervous. That's awesome. We're talking to award-winning writer and author Ellen Zweibel about his new book, Laugh Lines, My Life, Helping Funny People Be Funnier. And there's more after this on 720 WGN.
This is the theme to Gary's show. The theme to Gary's show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to award-winning writer and producer Ellen Zweibel. We talk about his new book, Laugh Lines, My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. So, you know, fast forward a little bit. You know, before the Larry Sanders Show, there was It's Gary Shandling Show, which you co-created. It started with this 25th anniversary special of the Gary Shandling Show, which never really existed. You know, you kind of knew Gary from The Tonight Show. It was really a unique and groundbreaking show.
Well, Gary was going to do this retrospective of 25 years of the Gary Shandling talk show, a talk show that never existed, but it was basically a parody of the kind of shows that Carson did every time there was an anniversary where they would show clips, they would bring out guests, you know, and talk about the good old days. And I helped him with that. We had the same manager, a guy named Bernie Brillstein.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to L.A. and I helped him with the script. And we got to talking. I had an idea for a show. I was married and we had two children at the time. And we now have three, but we had two children. And I wanted to write a show about a comedy writer with a wife and a couple of kids, where the comedy writer spoke to camera as if Dick Van Dyke.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that would have been, that's what I was thinking. Gary had an idea where he played himself a comedian who lived alone, who spoke to camera. We basically melded the two ideas together, and we came up with his Gary Shandling Show. And I've got to tell you that for me, David, that it was like lightning struck again. You know, I had this glorious collaborative relationship with Gilda Radner when I was at SNL. And now here was this guy Shandling that we got along with really, really well. And the show you're talking about, we wrote the theme song to the show in an elevator. One elevator ride. You know, if you remember, it was a show that made fun of situation comedies.
Right.
And I said to him, he said, you know, we're going to need a theme song. I said, yeah, what are you thinking? Now we get into the elevator. He goes, I'm thinking about doing, maybe we should have a theme song about a theme song. And I go, what does that mean? And he says, this is the theme to Gary's show. The theme to Gary's show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write a theme song. And I said, I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary's show? And then he said, this is the theme to Gary's show, the opening theme to Gary's show. This is the music that you hear as you watch the credits. Then I said, I'm almost to the part where we start to whistle, and then we'll watch his Gary's Shandling show.
We
both started whistling, and then he looked at me and goes, this was the theme to Gary's Shandling show. Elevator doors open. We're in the lobby.
Done.
It's only 11 o'clock in the morning, but it was a full day. We both went home.
That's great. That's great.
It was magical. It was really magical.
Well, and was also magical, as you mentioned, is this collaboration that you had with Gilda on SNL and with Gary. You brought both of them together when Gilda made an appearance on the show. And I remember how watching that episode, how impactful that was.
Well, you know something, Gilda had cancer, and I was her platonic friend since SNL,
right.
And I didn't want it to be platonic, okay? But I figured, okay, if these are the rules, I'll live by them. One day you'll open your eyes and just behold the glory in front of you.
Of course, so
I was her platonic friend, and she got cancer, and she loved this Gary Shandling show, and she came on as a guest, all right? Mm-hmm. And we didn't tell the studio audience, and the minute she walked through the door, and she hadn't been on television in 6 or 7
years.
She had been sick, and she brought the house down with laughter. She made a couple of cancer jokes, which she asked me to help write her. And the audience, all of a sudden, David, it's like they hesitated for a second, you know, a joke about cancer, and as if they computed it the same way. Oh, she has it, so she can. And then they started laughing more and more. They got emotional, and it was a glorious evening. And we thought that she was in remission. And then the cancer took over again, and I had to make her laugh. That was the one thing that she asked of me when she got sick. So I had to make my platonic friend laugh. So I remember she went to Cedar Sinai Hospital in L.A., I went there to give blood. I'm lying on the gurney, and a nurse comes over with a pad and a pen. And I said, well, what's this for? She says, Gilda likes to know whose blood she's getting. Say something nice. She's having a tough time. So I wrote, dear Gilda, I knew I'd get some fluid of mine into you one way or another.
I bet you she loved that.
Yeah, she laughed a lot at it. You know, I had to make her laugh, you know.
Oh man, that's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And you know, with Gary, you know, you had a falling out like friends do. You were well on your way to mending that relationship later in life, and then he passed away. And this is what I find just so moving, is you ended up delivering Gary's eulogy.
Yeah, it was very emotional. Gary and I stopped talking to each other at the end of the 72 episodes we did. My wife, Robin, brokered a peace between the two of us. But still, you know, Gary would return one out of every 3 phone calls, answer maybe one out of every 3 or 4 emails. And I took whatever I could get, you know.
Yeah.
And we were starting to move closer. He used to have these wonderful basketball games on Sundays. Whoever was in town, whether it be Ben Stiller, Judd Apatow, he would have these games that we'd play basketball.
Sure.
I played in them, and we started making amends, you know. And then I was out in L.A. This one particular weekend. I was working on the script of Here Today with Billy Crystal, and I kept calling Gary to try to, you know, have dinner with him on the Sunday night, and it didn't work out. We said, okay, listen, I'm going back to New York tomorrow. We decided that we were going to speak Thursday night of the coming week, and he died Thursday morning, you know. So it was incomplete, the finding of each other again, but the circle was on its way to being there. And when Judd asked me to eulogize him at the memorial, my wife Robin and I, we flew out to LA from New York, and it was really cathartic. And it was the last piece in the puzzle. It was the closest I can get to him, and what I said, the jokes, his jokes that I told, and speaking from the heart, including the falling out, it was very, very therapeutic. Writers are very lucky that way. They can just tap into what they're feeling, and if they express it honestly, it's really cathartic, or it's really healing, you know?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And, you know, I had interviewed Judd a couple of years ago when he did that docuseries on HBO on Gary, and it was very clear that those basketball games at his house and so forth was just a bonding time for his closest friends.
That's exactly what it was. It had nothing to do with show business or jokes or being comedians, you know, and it was just being guys, you know, guys.
Yeah.
the first game that I played, Gary says, he points to this girl, okay, this young girl, goes, "God, her." And I go, "Oh, God, he's starting with me again. He's pissing me off again. I got a God." Well, it was Sarah Silverman, and she ran me ragged.
Wow.
She was dropping deuces from the top of the team, and she, I couldn't cover her. I'm dreadful at basketball, but this was ridiculous.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, great bonding time for sure. You had a lifelong friendship with Larry David. You got involved in Curb Your Enthusiasm as well. You had many influences along the way. You gave many of them kudos in the book. Would you say there were more writers than comedians that influenced you, or vice versa?
Well, my idols were the ones who wrote. Now, they might have performed and or writers.
Sure.
But, you know, how do you categorize Carl Reiner?
Right.
You know, my friend Buck Henry, who is a mentor of mine, was a wonderful writer. Look at the movies that he wrote, like The Graduate, and he co-created Get Smart with Mel Brooks. But he was on camera, and but I would say that if you asked him what he was first, I think he was a writer, you know?
Sure.
And I looked at them, and I go, all right, this is what I want to do, you know? And you get a guy like Buck, who died last December when he was 89, but he was in the middle of writing a book. Carl Reiner is 98 and keeps churning out books.
I just talked to Carl a few weeks ago. I talked to him every 6 months because he's always got something. And that's a secret, by the way, you know, to his longevity is he keeps moving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that if he stopped, then he would be in trouble. But it's like a shark. You got to keep going. And he does that, you know. And, you know, Woody Allen, you can name the, Norman Lear.
Larry Gelb,
who are now in their late 80s, 90s, it's just this long list, and this is what they do. And they defy the odds because it's a younger person's game, you know?
It is.
But they, you know, and I learned something from them. I learned that, look, if this is what you do, even if you're not in vogue at the moment, okay, the wheel turns, and you write what's, you know, the movie that I just wrote with Billy, I could not have written, neither could he have 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, because that wasn't our life experiences. So I just learned from these guys, be yourself. I couldn't write for SNL anymore. You know, it's like, it's my alma mater.
Sure.
But just like I can't play football for my old high school team, I can't. It would sound like an old, I'm going to be 70.
70. I know. What is this 70? How did you become 70? That's crazy.
When did that happen?
Well, I got to tell you, and we're only touching upon some of the stories in this book. I mean, your journey is so fascinating and honestly so much fun. And I so enjoyed reading the new book. It's called Laugh Lines, My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. And of course, you can get that wherever books are sold. What a thrill to talk to you, Alan, and so glad you could share just a few of these great stories with our listeners in this fabulous new book.
Oh, it's certainly my pleasure. It really is. And I know that everybody, that whether it's Judd or Carl or whoever else you have on your show, everybody flocks to you, and I see why. You're great to talk to, and I really appreciate you having me on.
An honor hearing that from you. Thank you so much, sir, and be well.
Take care.
All right. It's 720 WGN.